Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's me, John Voquette, your Director of Public Affairs. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning Public Affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, today we're going to open revisiting the subject of education as it relates to our state's workforce and our future, and how the Connecticut Science Center is ramping up a brand new program called STEM Career Connections to inspire students in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and setting them on a path to careers in our state and today's economy. Then we're going to further explore the effects of global warming on our state with the director from the Council on Environmental Quality. Listen in and hear about solid evidence on how global warming is promoting the expansion of certain species while others, like lobsters, are just heading north to cooler waters. And finally, we'll throw the show into neutral and catch up with our state spokesperson for AAA to learn about several initiatives and studies that can impact your safety on our roadways, like hazards related to in-car infotainment systems, the state's Slow Down, Move Over initiative, and the importance of checking your vehicle for a Takata airbag recall. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Hey, the Aviel Foundation's 2019 Brainstorm Experience Season 2 continues with the 7th Annual Newtown Yoga Festival. This year, the event is happening Saturday, August 24th from 9 to 4 at the newly opened Newtown Community Center at Fairfield Hills, just off Route 25 and 84. This year's festival will feature a morning yoga buffet, chair yoga, yin yoga, yoga nidra, journey dancing, the Namaste bus, selling yoga apparel and lunch, farm fresh from Aquarian Caterers, and more. Tickets are $40 when purchased in advance online and $50 at the door. So register now and save $10 at newtownyogafestival.org. Well, as I was just saying to our guest, it's been a long time since we were able to chat with someone from the Connecticut Science Center, which has recently announced something really important, actually a subject that we've engaged the Science Center on previously, a brand new program called STEM Career Connections. And we're going to talk about that today with the museum's public programs manager, Megan Raymer. Beyond the introduction, tell us a little bit about yourself and when you came to the Science Center and how you fit into this larger overall mission.
Yeah, it's really a wonderful kind of story that I am really happy to be here, because I came to the Science Center about 5 years ago. I came out of the classroom. I was actually an elementary school teacher and then an instructional coach to first-year teachers throughout the state, and I grew up in Connecticut. And when I left for college and, you know, teaching, the Science Center did not exist. So showing back up, 5 years ago, somebody said, check out this great new place. And lo and behold, I got to be their public programs manager, which means I really get to build the experiences that visitors have when they come in our galleries.
Well, the Science Center was a pretty darn cool place just to look at from the street. But once you get inside, oh, my gosh, it just is. You could spend days there, never mind a day or a few hours to Hartford and check this out. But in your tenure, Megan, and looking back since the center opened, what are a couple of the most exciting exhibits or presentations that you've had an opportunity to have real impact on?
So most recently, we opened a new gallery called the Engineering Lab. So in the science world, there's a big push in making and tinkering and really building some strong skills in our youth, right? The ability to try new things, test out your design, re-engineer it if it didn't work and figure out why, and then test it again. So when we, two years ago now, so 2017, we kind of took on this task of how do we bring that mindset to an exhibit in our science gallery and start to get kids thinking about engineering in a different way and kind of getting rid of that stereotype of what an engineer is, right? The person that sits behind a computer working on blueprints or it builds bridges, and kind of open that up and open up the different fields of engineering and show kind of the problems that they work on every day, and that, you know, they make our lives even easier because of it. We wouldn't have cell phone technology and computer games without people in engineering fields. So we actually opened up a new exhibit on our fourth floor that highlights just that. It looks at mechanical engineering, and you get to try and build a helicopter to solve a problem, right? Rescue mm-hmm. people from an oil rig or that are trapped on a mountain, and kind of putting this word we've heard in a lot of different ways, engineering, into a real life situation that visitors can, you know, interact with and try for themselves. Yeah. So that's been really fun for me.
Good, good. Well, as we broadcast this program here in mid-August, there's still a lot of summer left, although it's just probably a week or two before kids start heading back to school. This is kind of that time of the year where parents and caregivers and camp counselors and stuff and such are really looking for some cool things to do to kind of, put the cap on a great summer. And I guess one of the really cool things that they could do before September 1st is to head up to the Science Center to see the real bodies exhibit that you guys have. They used to have to schlep all the way down to New York City to see this exhibit, but for some time it has been a huge draw for you folks at the Science Center, right?
It has, and we only have it for a little bit longer, but it really gives visitors a chance to see this amazing compact package that we don't even think about all the different functions it does for us on a daily basis, everything from breathing to digesting to fighting illness. Our body is this perfect machine that, you know, if you come and explore real bodies, you can see just how each one of those pieces work together and how the muscles protect our skeleton and, you know, our digestive system is neatly packed in there, but yet does so much for our bodies. So it really gives visitors a great insight into the bodies and how they operate. And I mean, when else do you get a chance to come explore real human bodies?
Right, right. And something else that a lot of young people today are very, very separated from due to time, but who can come to the Science Center and sort of relive it because they've been seeing and hearing about it so much in the news and in the media, is you've got a tribute to the Apollo 11 mission.
Yes, we do. We have a few things that kind of go along that Apollo 11 storyline. So one, we have the fantastic movie in our theater that has never before seen footage as it's leading up to the mission and really gives a good glimpse into the kind of excitement and the planning that went into this amazing feat that we did 50 years ago with computers that were much bigger than the ones we now hold in our hands. So the movie experience is fascinating. And then we recently just unveiled a Connecticut flag that actually went to the International Space Station. So we are proud to honor that kind of trip it took in our space exhibit gallery. Mm-hmm. And then we have a number of different hands-on programming that explore space and, you know, future space fields and some of the unique exoplanets and bodies that are out there and really bring that to the conversation for our visitors and families.
Great. Well, before we drill in and talk deeply about the brand new STEM career connections, there is something that is somewhat related. As we broadcast our interview with you on the 11th of August, it would be this coming Saturday, August 17th, that you have an edition of Women in Science Saturday, which is part of a great partnership that you've had with the Pettit Family Foundation.
Yes. So, on Saturdays, we will actually bring in specific Saturdays different female scientists from a variety of fields, and our visitors get a chance to interact with them and explore a little bit about what they do on a day-to-day basis, do some type of interactive experiment that really showcases what they do. So coming up, we actually have an evolutionary biologist that is talking about reptiles and some of their fascinating adaptations, and really this initiative allows us to highlight women that are doing science in some really cool and fascinating ways and hopefully inspire some young girls that they can also go into some really cool sciences while giving them a fun hands-on experience.
Excellent. Well, folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Megan Raymer. She's the Public Programs Manager for the Connecticut Science Center in Hartford. You can't miss it if you're driving up along the river. CTSciencecenter.org is the website you go to find out about all these exhibits and activities, including the Bodies exhibit, which is only running through September 1st. So if you have not seen that or plan to, you really should get that scheduling together now. So, Megan, now comes a deep dive into this newest offering. And as I said earlier, coincidentally, probably the last time we engaged the Connecticut Science Center was around your fantastic exposure of STEM opportunities to younger people. And this STEM Career Connections apparently is doing what a lot of the experts talking about STEM on the award-winning For the People have been talking about, and that is starting them younger and younger and younger. Kindergarten, not too young for STEM exposure, even younger perhaps, right?
Right. So, you know, we are at a really great opportunity here because the Science Center has a great audience of youth. And the research that's out there right now is telling us that if a youth by the age of, you know, 13, 14 has a strong interest in STEM, they'll be more likely to see themselves in a STEM career in the future. And with our current economy and, you know, some of the major employers in the state being STEM employers, you know, they need a workforce. And so the Science Center is poised to be able to not only spark the interest, but now help connect our youth and their parents and educators with some knowledge about the availability and the presence of some exciting jobs and careers in STEM. And even explaining what STEM is to parents and kids, because it's a word we hear a lot, and we know what the acronym means, right? Science, technology, engineering, and math. Mm. But we have the ability to actually expose them to what it might look like to go into a career in STEM. And really, there's not a job you could look at in today's society that's very digital and technologically based that doesn't have a STEM professional working for them. Mm. So we, you know, have the ability to showcase that through a variety of different ways. So we have a number of hands-on programming that we've built in STEM Career Connections, and we've started to actually really focus on the skills needed to be a strong, essentially, employee in STEM fields in the futures, right? The mm-hmm. essential skill building for critical thinking and problem solving and what it means to work in a team and to be a strong communicator. So not only can we expose them to careers, but we can also build the skills that they need.
Hmm. Is there some plan to or an existing curriculum that begins to not only bring and expose young people to this field, but also to introduce them to some of the growing and flourishing businesses that we have here in Connecticut that are going to be dependent on some of these young people really becoming passionate about STEM careers and being part of the future workforce?
Absolutely. And I know you mentioned that you guys had talked with us about this before, and really why we're kind of digging our heels in and jumping on this initiative now is because, you know, we have the ability to partner with some of the region's kind of top employers that are saying, hey, we have these opportunities. We have these great jobs. We want people to be aware of this because we want a future workforce. So we've recently partnered with the Hartford and Cognizant to bring forth this STEM Career Connections initiative. And one of the cornerstones of that is what we're calling our STEM Career Showcases. So multiple times throughout the year, our next one is October 22nd, we're actually bringing in those professionals that are working in the businesses that, you know, you see or you drive by from all over the state to have them create a hands-on and informal opportunity for our students and our parents and our educators to actually talk to them about what they do. You know, what does it look like to be a data architect at an insurance company, or what does it mean to work in software development? So we really want to provide them with the access to these people in an informal way. It's not a job fair. It's not a college fair. But at the same time we're exposing them, we're also highlighting the range of opportunities out there, because The reality in our society is not everything needs a six-year advanced degree to be in STEM. You know, there's jobs as technicians and in advanced manufacturing that are accessible and ready now, but we don't necessarily know what they look like or what some of the projects or the tools they work with are. So by bringing the professionals in to the Science Center, we can showcase that and marry our skills as science communicators with the experiences that the STEM professionals can provide to really help expose kids and their families to what it actually means to be in a STEM career.
So in the last minute or so that we have with you, Megan, let folks know how they can get involved.
So you can come up any day of the week. We have regular hands-on live science activities out on our floors that build some of these STEM skills, the critical thinking and the problem solving, but also connect them to the pathways that they might take to get to the careers. And those happen on a daily basis. And then, you know, coming up next, we have a STEM career showcase in October. And if you don't want to wait that long, you can reach out to us because we also will come to you. We do have our traveling programs and our outreach that go all over and really bring this message to people if they can't quite make it up to our building.
Great. But, go ahead. But
I was going to say, they definitely should. We have real bodies here through September 1st and a number of great experiences.
Right. As we said, put a spectacular cap on a great summer of 2019 by visiting or revisiting the Connecticut Science Center, this nonprofit dedicated to enhancing science education throughout the state of Connecticut and New England. As you're hearing, providing learning opportunities for students and adults of all ages and engaging the community in scientific exploration. If you need to call them, it's real easy. 860-SCIENCE, or check them out at ctsciencecenter.org on the web. Our guest has been Megan Reamer. She's Public Programs Manager at the Connecticut Science Center. Megan, thank you for being part of the program and helping expose us to this brand new and exciting workforce development initiative, STEM Career Connections, happening at the Connecticut Science Center now and into the fall and winter. We hope you'll be able to attend. Thank you, Megan. Well, regular listeners to the program going way back, not as far as 1971, but pretty far back into the, at least into the early 90s, know that a great resource of ours has been Connecticut's Council on Environmental Quality that has been doing its good work since 1971, producing Connecticut's annual report on the status of the environment to the governor and the legislature, as well as taking up various studies and producing important data that's not only used in government circles, but by many agencies. We're so pleased to have their director on with the line with us this morning. Peter Hearns is with us, and we're going to be talking about a recent development as the council was developing its current 2019 report, which reflected on data available from 2018. Some of that information came in late, and so it is going to be actually produced as part of next year CEQ annual report to the governor and legislature. But we're going to talk about that because it has imminent impact and affects really not just the environment, but there's several aspects of it that involve the quality of life for us here in Connecticut, including the future of songbirds here and our beloved lobster population, which do important work on the seabeds here in Long Island Sound adjacent to Connecticut, but also make a darn great meal for so many people here in the summertime and year-round. Peter Hearns, thank you for joining us. And first of all, beyond that, a brief introduction. Let's talk a little bit about these legislative directives that you're under. There's three of them that you primarily focus on?
When the council was formed, the legislature gave the council three directives. One is to produce an annual report to the governor on, and probably our most important job is to do that. And the report is on Connecticut's environment, trends in Connecticut's environment, and recommendations for changes in policy. And that's a big part of our focus. And the other things that we do, we're required to send a notice to every town hall regarding state actions that affect the environment, and that goes out twice a month, and to receive citizen complaints. And sort of a corollary of the citizen complaint directive is people will almost bring issues to the council that concern them, often local issues, things that are happening in their town. But that is often for the council an insight into bigger problems or problems that might be statewide, and those have led to special reports by the council. And I could think of one that had an effect in state legislation recently. People were complaining that their valued forests were being cut down for, you know, forests are a good thing. Mm. And solar panels are a good thing. But if you're cutting a forest to put in solar panels, is that a good thing? So people, we were getting a number of complaints about that. Mm. And we did a study and looked at the number of acres, the number of acres that were being lost to solar construction under state authorization, because you need to get a permission to do that. And compared it to the number of acres that were of farmland and forest land that were being annually preserved by the state at taxpayer expense. I seem to have a frog in my throat today.
No,
but and the acreage in round numbers was very close. So we did a report pointing out that it doesn't make sense really to be spending taxpayer resources acquiring forest and prime farmland and then authorizing that forest and prime farmland be lost to solar projects.
Yeah, and it speaks. It speaks to a greater kind of disparity. Is it better to conserve fossil fuel by producing solar energy, or are we kind of cutting off our nose to spite our face environmentally by doing these wholesale reductions in parcels that are not only producing environmental benefits to the forest floor, but also producing a lot of oxygen, right?
Sure, for sure. And there is an analysis typically that's done in the case of replacing a forest with a solar facility. And generally, over the long term, the amount of carbon dioxide that is saved is greater than the amount of carbon dioxide absorption that a forest would provide over the really long term. Mm. So, nevertheless, wouldn't it be nice to have both?
Yes.
So the legislation that was passed stated that you can't put a solar farm on prime farmland or in core forest, which is defined as pretty much 100 yards from the nearest non-forest, without a sign-off from either the commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection or the commissioner of agriculture. So it gave the agencies charged with the responsibility of preserving those resources a chance to look at the proposals regarding solar siting.
Mm.
And so it's an attempt to try to get both. Let's have the forests and let's have the solar.
Mm. So, in relation to that new legislation, was any thought given or any discussions mounted as to what happens if, say, the DEEP commissioner is in favor of such a project and the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture is vehemently against it? I mean, what happens when there's, the potential of conflict between these two agencies?
So the way the legislation was structured is that the Commissioner of Agriculture signs off on the, or doesn't sign off on the farmland, and DEEP would have the authority regarding creating an opinion regarding forest land.
Oh, I see. So it's two separate jurisdictions.
Right.
So to speak. Good. Well, turning our attention to the full report that was developed for May, as I understood from a briefing that we did before we went on air this morning, there was you were waiting for some data, particularly on Connecticut bird populations that you hope to include in 2018. That data came too late for the production and delivery of that report. So you put out a special report on the impact of climate change on Connecticut wildlife. Let's talk about that.
Okay. The genesis of that actually goes back to a similar analysis that we did of Long Island Sound and the finfish in Long Island Sound. A number of years ago, we asked the simple question of, well, if the animal populations are changing in Long Island Sound, which we had an indicator that they were, to what degree are those reflected in fish that prefer warm temperature water versus cold temperature water? And in looking at that, we discovered that, well, the number of cold preference fish was on the decline over time, and the number of warm preference fish was on a significant increase. So we asked ourselves the question, well, is that reflected in any other populations? You know, wildlife being, you're always sampling wildlife.
Sure.
You know, you never, it's not like the U.S. Census where, you know, everybody reports. It's, mm-hmm. You do these moments in time and try to figure out what the trends are.
Yeah, and I guess it's important to assert that when there is a rapid shift in species, one or more of them, there could be an environmental domino effect, however subtle, right?
For sure. And we looked at, we were able to get data from the Breeding Bird Survey, which is an annual survey done across the country.
Mm-hmm.
We got the data for Connecticut. And in looking at the data, it was very clear that birds that prefer cold temperatures were on a significant decrease in Connecticut since about 2011. And warm preference birds were increasing. So initially, both populations were tracking pretty closely, but around 2011, the cold population seemed to diverge significantly from the warm population. And, you know, cause and effect is always difficult in nature, but it seems commonsensical that this is tied into climate. And that was the point of the news release that we did. We didn't want to save it till the next annual report, which would be coming out next May. We thought with all the discussion about climate and all that's going on a federal level with regard to cutbacks at EPA and all the denial that's going on, we thought we should just release it now. It'll also be in the annual report, but it just seemed like an important bit of information to get out.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Peter Hearns, the executive director of the Connecticut Council on Environmental Quality, and we'll pick up the conversation about how Connecticut's habitat and environment is being affected by global warming and the increase or reduction of certain species of wildlife. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations that would love to have your support. And you can learn about many of them through LoveCT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto LoveCT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. Hey, I'm Connoisseur Media's Director of Public Affairs, John Vauquet. We're going to get back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Gateway Community College in New Haven will open from 9 to 2 on Saturdays, August 17th and 24th for Super Saturday registration sessions to assist students interested in attending fall 2019 classes. Classes start on Tuesday, August 27th, and the registration event is open to new and continuing students. Faculty and staff will assist with advising, registration, financial aid, and graduation workshops. New students remember to bring a photo ID, unofficial transcripts, proof of high school graduation, and immunization records with you. Academic placement testing will be available after the application process is complete. GCC is located at 20 Church Street in downtown New Haven, and validated parking is available at the Temple Street Garage. Just bring your ticket to any GCC security desk. Hey, you want more information? Just visit gatewayct.edu. We're back with Peter Hearns. He's Executive Director of the Connecticut Council on Environmental Quality. So in terms of what Connecticut is losing and what Connecticut is gaining, I mean, no matter whether you live in the thickest urban neighborhoods or the most far-flung rural areas of town, there's nothing like wandering out in the yard or along a trail, early in the morning or early in the evening, and just hearing that chorus of songbirds and the joy of seeing brightly colored birds all kind of, you know, feeding at the backyard bird feeder and things like that, the hummingbirds and such. Are there some specific species that you can talk about that we will be seeing less of or are seeing less of versus those that we may be seeing more of?
Sure. You will be hearing songs, but you'll be hearing songs from different birds. So the ones that seem to be on the decline. It's a fairly large list. I could
And what are the, a couple of the ones that we would tend to see anywhere in the state that are prolific?
Good question. How about the veery, the black-throated green warbler, the bobolink? Cedar waxwing. How about that? those are all cold climate adapted species that are on the decline. I'm not much of a birder. I mean, my wife could answer this better than I could. But,
Well, are you kind of looped in from a networking perspective to see in other more northern states that the population that may have once flourished more heavily in Connecticut are now kind of shifting up into northern Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, and other points north?
That seems to be the case. And the other problem associated with birds is they're migratory. So they're declining here, and you know, a census of birds, if you have less birds of any given species, you don't know whether it's because there's something happening here or something happening where they go in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the value to doing the analysis of warm adapted versus cold adapted, because if you see a decrease in cold adapted and not a decrease in warm adapted, that's probably more of an indicator that it's climate-based and not other factors like loss of habitat, you know, where they winter.
So. Yeah, and I guess there are certain bird species that have greater positive or negative impact on things like farmlands and forests as well. So I'm assuming this type of watchfulness on the part of the CEQ in developing these studies is certainly important long term when we look at how those species impact environmental health.
Sure.
Excellent. Very good. One of the other things that this report looked at was fish populations. You mentioned that a little bit earlier, that there are some colder preference fish that are no longer as prolific here in Connecticut waters. And we have heard on several fronts from guests talking about environmental concerns about the lobster population, not just from an environmental impact a point of view, but from an economic impact here in Connecticut. Can you tell us a little bit more in the last few minutes that we have with you, Peter Hearns, about the some of the discoveries that came out of the report in regards to fish populations?
Well, I can. I didn't. I don't have in front of me the species that we tracked, but we tracked a large number of cold water, warm water preference animals. Scores of them, and you know, there was so many. I mean, we had far many more fish species than we had bird species to track. You know, there was no doubt that that the trend that we just discussed in birds is also happening in Long Island Sound. And with regard to lobster, the data we get is from samples that are done by Department of Energy and Environmental Protection and the Department of Agriculture going out on Long Island Sound and actually trawling for animals, bringing them up, counting what is there, returning them to the water. So, you know, it's a sampling process. But the numbers got so low with lobster that for the last few years, if you're looking at the chart in our annual report, it's pretty much, you know, 0 to 1 and almost unreadable. So we're looking at, for next year, looking at and including in the report the commercial landings of lobster, which are larger numbers, but also following the same trend, where there's just been a real collapse in the lobster population in the last decade.
Yeah, I was able to key into your website. Folks, if you're interested in checking this information out and learning more yourself, you can go to ct.gov/CEQ for the Council on Environmental Quality. There is a shocking side-by-side graphic of the difference between lobster catches in Long Island Sound adjacent to Connecticut and going down into New York and New Jersey in 1990 versus 2014. And Peter, I see what you're talking about. The population by 2014 has just like substantially moved into those northern Maine and lower Canadian Atlantic waters. It's just, it mirrors the Arctic ice melt imaging that we're seeing. It's just amazing.
Yeah, for if there are still climate doubters out there, the NERA report is a good wake-up call. Mm-hmm. Also an excellent tool for teachers that might want to, you know, get some data into a classroom that, that you know, is dynamic. It changes every year. It just, you know, it's all there.
Yeah. Well, in the last few minutes, we want to tap you for some advice and information on what the average Connecticut citizen might be able to do, either through advocacy or action or both, to at least, you know, hedge against this growing trend of global climate warmth.
Yes, certainly personal behavior is perhaps at root of the entire process, but you know, in terms of turning things around, making things better, we track driving—the number of people who move in their car daily. Miles driven per Connecticut resident is one of the things we track, and we saw a significant decrease since the recession in miles driven, for perhaps obvious economic reasons, and as the economy has gotten slightly better, that seems to be increasing. So, you know, reducing your mileage, car sharing. We also track bus travel. Mm. And we saw the same sort of thing where after the recession, bus travel increased in terms of ridership and then has begun to decrease by 2017. It was lower than it was way back to where it had been back in 2013, I think.
Oh, okay.
It did level off 2017 and 2018 pretty much the same. But, you know, taking the bus, driving a fuel-efficient car, all of those things are things that can help. The state does have some goals for reducing the amount of greenhouse gas produced. And the state right now is on track to meet its goal for 2050. So if people... But people have to continue to reduce if you continue to do things the same way, because the track needs to get lower and lower if it's clear. Like, so the goal for 2050 is fairly low, but we're on track to meet it based on where we were in 2003. So reductions. So if we keep that trend, we will probably hit the goal. But to keep the trend, we have to continue to improve our behavior, you know, insulate our houses, use less energy, take the bus, things.
Very good. Lots of other information, as you heard, not just for Connecticut residents who may have general interest, but also for educators, for young and older students in the Council's 2018 annual report, Environmental Quality in Connecticut, which identifies a number of environmental trends that are affected by warming climate. You can get this information as well as plenty of other guidance and important details by visiting the Council's website, ct.gov/CEQ, serving Connecticut since 1971. The Council on Environmental Quality produces Connecticut's annual report on the status of the environment and special reports, as we are hearing about today with Peter Hearns, Executive Director of the CEQ. Peter, I really appreciate you phoning in and chatting with us this morning about this new data and these important developments with our bird and fish populations. And we'll look forward to talking with you again as the 2019 report becomes available next year. Appreciate the call. Well, I cross paths with my in-studio guest a lot, and she has also been a great resource, both in the background and directly to the award-winning For the People. We go back many years, many years. Fran Mako is here, and she's representing AAA Northeast, which, you know, if you're a member and your car breaks down, you run out of gas, so you need a new battery replaced, or something else happens, you make your call, and the trusty AAA responders come out and take good care of you. But AAA is so much more. They have an incredible resource in terms of the research that they either directly do or partner on that has an immense amount of valuable information for drivers, particularly in the areas of safety. And we're going to be talking about a few of those things in just a few minutes. Fran, thank you for joining us here and coming on up to the studio.
Well, thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it.
So beyond the introduction, just kind of give a little bit of a broader explanation about AAA, because
sure.
While it is a brand that is globally known, it's not one big company or organization that serves the entire country.
That's right.
Or North America. What's
That's
the
right.
story with that?
Well, think of the Hawaiian Islands. The Hawaiian Islands are five islands. So AAA is similar. Huh. You have the AAA brand. The umbrella name is AAA. But throughout the country, you have individual clubs. So each individual club is a standalone club, but there are reciprocal agreements and services. For example, in road service, if you break down, if you're a member of our club, which is AAA Northeast, and you break down in California, you can still call AAA and they'll come out and get you because we have these reciprocal services.
Okay. Well, as we said, AAA is a great resource. You do political advocacy, public safety information. We're going to talk about a couple of those. Let's start with probably something that may have the greatest potential hazardous impact on drivers here in Connecticut, aside from those that may be imposed on them by maybe impaired drivers or distracted drivers. And that is a hazard that's lurking right there in
That's
their
right.
steering wheel.
That's right. And I likened it to a ticking time bomb.
Mm-hmm.
About 4 years ago, NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, had put out a recall on these airbags produced by Takata Corporation. And basically at the time, and still actually, these airbags were defective in nature because they would over time degrade because of high temps and high humidity. And as people were driving, they would explode. So you can imagine that would be a problem. And there have been about 250, maybe more injuries, but about 16 known deaths. Since that time, it's come to NHTSA's attention that there are still 17 million defective airbags out there. There's a variety of manufacturers, and it's an easy fix if people know they have a Takata airbag. And in order to find out, I mean, looking at your steering wheel, you're not going to know. Looking at your manual, you're not going to know. You need to plug your VIN ID, your vehicle identification number, into a website, into NHTSA's website. It will tell you if your particular car has that airbag.
Well, that's super important information, because I think maybe what discourages a lot of people when they hear about the fact that they have to learn whether or not they have the airbag is the automatic thought is, oh my gosh, I got to make an appointment at my garage. Maybe
but
it's going to cost me money. Maybe they're going to, find some other things wrong. But the individual can take personal control over the
That's
at
right.
least the basic knowledge just by going to the website.
That's right. And the best of all, I mean, you do have to make an appointment with your dealer. I would go to a dealer on something like this, but it's free. I mean, it'll probably take up maybe half a day of your time.
And that's only if you have the airbag
That's
based
right.
on the query.
That's right. Now, the good news is that in Connecticut, there have been no deaths. I did some research on this.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yep.
The bad news is you don't know if you have the airbag unless you check.
Right.
But it's mostly places in the South where there is really high temperatures and high humidity
yeah, sure.
that causes these airbags
spontaneous explosion
to
yeah.
degrade.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I liken it to a ticking time bomb, because if you don't know and if it goes off,
right.
you're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
Now, I know there are definitely, if you have a 2002, like Honda, Odyssey, Civics, Mazdas, they definitely are affected. Mm-hmm. So if you have an older car like that, you really need to get that car into a dealer.
Well, the bottom line is it could take potentially less than 60 seconds to access the NHTSA website. And all you need to do is get your cell phone and go right up in your front windshield there and zoom in really close and take a photo of the VIN number or take your registration into the computer with you. Enter that big, long number in, and it'll tell you. If you don't have one, you're off the hook. If you have one, then the process begins to contact your dealer for free, get the replacement for free. The only thing you have to invest is time, but with thousands of injuries and more than a dozen deaths related to these airbags, it just makes sense. It's great that AAA is being part of that more kind of global reminder system. One of the other things that's an advent of contemporary motor vehicles is the rapid development of the onboard computerized systems that are called infotainment systems. And as I have often been tapping AAA's science resources, this is the latest to come out of the AAA research initiative.
Yes. Over the years, there have been seven different studies that the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety, which is the research arm of AAA, has partnered with the University of Utah to do work on distracted driving. The distracted driving guru is a fellow by the name of Dr. David Strayer, mm-hmm. who has really done groundbreaking research on distracted driving. In the old days, we used to think hands-free cell phoning or talking is a lot safer than handheld, when research has found there's really no difference between each. And he has since expanded his research on all these gadgets and infotainment systems in the brand new cars, which may or may not work as simply as we would like.
Yeah, and they're certainly like a roulette machine in terms of their visual enticing the eyes momentarily off the road, right?
I mean, a lot of this stuff is very distracting. You have a screen on your dashboard and you're looking at it and you're reaching for it. And we've been working with manufacturers to hopefully make these systems a lot more user-friendly. They're not going to go away. We are too connected to our cell phones. Yeah. And despite the fact that people go, I don't text or use my cell phone while I drive, people do. We do it all the time.
Or even if it's just listening to music or hanging up on a call and cars are becoming much more computer centric. And these screens and infotainment centers also serve as a way for the car, so to speak, to tell the driver, oh, you've got very low tire pressure in one of your tires. Yes. You're about to run out of gas. You're overheating or something else is wrong. So I guess the major concern in this recent study has been how these infotainment systems may impact the attention span or the attention of particularly older drivers.
Any of these systems, most of these systems are poorly designed. They're too complex. They're not positioned in your car so that they are easily accessible. So they serve as distractions to all drivers. But as we age, we have visual, cognitive, and some physical drawbacks. Sure. And this particular study has found that older drivers are distracted more than 8 seconds longer than their younger counterparts, which could be problematic because we're a society where we're a lot more mobile. Baby boomers are becoming of age, so there are going to be a lot more older drivers. And believe me, I use the term older loosely because I'm one of them.
We're among them, yeah.
but when you start getting up in age, your reaction time is not as quick as a younger driver. Mm-hmm. So we brought this to the attention of people. Be very, very careful when you are using these systems and know how to use them before you actually are moving in your car.
Right. It's just part of the training that you need to get when you acquire these vehicles, whether they're new or used. The sales person or the person who is turning over the vehicle really needs to spend significantly more time in ensuring older people really understand the ins and outs of these big screens and all the information that's behind them.
That's right.
So in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Fran, another initiative that I know is near and dear not only to AAA across the country, but particularly here in Connecticut, as well as to our emergency responders, that includes towing operators.
That's right.
This is the Slow Down Move Over initiative, which lots of billboards, lots of media on this, but yet every day it seems I drive by blinking lights on the side of the road and I'm moving over to the left and slowing down, and two or three people behind me see that open right lane and they jam their gas on and speed right by these poor tow truck operators that are inches away.
Slow Down Move Over is near and dear to our heart because, well, first, the law says that if you see an emergency responder or a vehicle with flashing lights on the side of the road helping a disabled motorist, you need to slow down to a reasonable speed under the existing speed limit. And if you can, move over to the adjacent lane. Within the last two legislative sessions, the lawmakers have expanded that to any car. So if you see any disabled car on the side of the road, you should slow down and move over. The reason why this is near and dear to our heart is one of our employees was a victim about 2 years ago of a violator of the Slow Down Move Over. Employee was a good Samaritan. He got out of his flatbed to help a non-member who was in a bad way, a bad position in Southport. And walking back to his flatbed, a runaway box truck collided with his flatbed and he ended up under that flatbed. We thought Jay was going to die. That's how bad it was. And that's when the company really embraced this program. And in fact, by the end of the year, we're going to do another push to make people aware. We're going to redevelop public service announcements, advertising, news releases. And unfortunately, every time a state police officer, in June, we had three of them, two or three incidents, I end up reminding people to take the law seriously. So this is our mission. To make people understand that particular law.
Excellent. Well, certainly, you know, fall and winter's coming. It's back to school. People want to make sure their cars are operating at peak efficiency. AAA also offers a lot of partnership benefits with repair garages and oil change facilities and other initiatives. They have on-site drive to the driver battery exchange programs. So lots of opportunities here to keep you and your family not only safe, but rolling efficiently on the roads by being part of the AAA network, to say nothing of the resources like we're hearing about today from Fran Mako from AAA Northeast. If you'd like more information, you get started at northeast.aaa.com. And we want to thank Fran Mako for being part of the program today. And Fran will be visiting with you more often, as you do with a number of other programs on our station. So thank you so much for joining us on
Thanks
the studio.
Thanks for having me, John.
Great.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.